From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. If you want to know how it feels to be a soldier in Iraq, Jason Christopher Hartley says he can help you. On today's Fresh Air, we'll hear from Hartley. He joined the Army National Guard at 17. About 13 years later, in 2004, he was sent to Iraq and spent 11 months in the Sunni Triangle. He wrote a blog about what he saw and what he felt about the Army, but he was told to shut down his site. He continued to keep a journal and send his entries as emails. Hartley's blog, JustAnotherSoldier.com, has been adapted into a book. And filmmaker Noah Baumbach talks with us. He made his mark with the post-college angst film Kicking and Screaming. His new film is called The Squid and the Whale. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new book, Just Another Soldier, is my guest Jason Christopher Hartley's journal of military life. He'd been a member of the Army National Guard for 13 years when he was called to active duty. He spent 2004 in Iraq's Sunni Triangle. His journal originated as a military blog, but shortly before he was sent to Iraq, he was told that his blog violated operational security and that he was smearing his unit and the Army. His company commander asked him to take the blog offline. Hartley complied. He continued to keep a journal and sent out his entries as emails. With 2 months left to serve in Iraq, he decided to put up his blog again. This time he was punished with a demotion and a $1,000 fine. Currently, his blog, justanothersoldier.com, has photographs and deleted scenes from his book. Now, recently, the U.S. Army Chief of Staff, General Peter Schoonmaker, complained that some soldiers have posted sensitive information on their blogs, including, quote, photos depicting weapon system vulnerabilities and tactics, techniques, and procedures. And he also expressed his concern about protecting the Army's image, both in the United States and in other countries, because he thought that some of these blogs were giving the Army a bad image. Do these sound legitimate complaints to you?
They are the closest to legitimate complaints anyone has made so far. Like he listed specifically, for example, as far as photographs go, to not post photographs of battle-damaged vehicles, like Humvees that have been hit by improvised explosive devices. There is some merit to that. For someone to know the kind, you know, how effective their attacks have been, that's one that I would even have to kind of think about. I mean, any photographs that I've had on my website that are similar to that, I've taken them down because of finding, you know, he says that, I'll take them down. And also the image one, that's a huge gray area as far as you're concerned. Yes, if you had every soldier putting up blogs saying how much they thought the war was unjustified, you know, okay, yeah, that could definitely erode what little support there might still be. You know, that's kind of a concern. But then it's like, well, where do these concerns end in, like, say, the First Amendment begin? I think his arguments are the most valid that anyone from the military has made so far about concerning blogs, but I don't think they're exactly watertight yet either.
Outside of the fact that writing the blog gave you a way to write and to express what you and the men around you were going through, what you were feeling, what did you get back from it? Did you get a lot of response to it?
I got quite a bit of response, and I think that was what really kept me doing it. It was so rewarding. Every time I would post a new story, I would get, you know, there'd be a lot of response back, and most of it positive. I would try to be as incendiary and as offensive as possible, just to try to get a rise out of somebody. And I really couldn't get it. People were so supportive, regardless of what I spoke about, and that really became the motivation to continue writing. It kept me sane, and it gave me a project, you know, kept my mind active the entire time that I was in Iraq and not on missions.
You write about the first time you fired a grenade, and you were basically on what you describe as ambush duty, looking for people who might be driving down the road planting roadside bombs. How were you given the order to fire on this specific vehicle that we'll be talking about?
Well, in this case, I wasn't given an order. We were part of a very small team. We had five guys. This was something that we were just beginning to do while we were. It was a tactic. These ambushes were a strategy our commanders had come up with that was ended up being very effective. And this was one of the first engagements that we had as a result of these ambush operations. And we had a vehicle that at the time we believed was definitely enemy. He was spotted planting 155-millimeter artillery rounds on the side of the road, which is the most common detonation charge in these improvised explosive devices guys put out. And he was fleeing, so we engaged the vehicle, and which included me. I expended about a magazine of rounds and a 40-millimeter grenade. Probably the most exciting thing, you know, one of the most exciting moments of my life was actually being able to engage that vehicle, making a concerted effort to kill someone. Turns out later the guy was a civilian. He wasn't an insurgent at all. His vehicle was overheating. He was trying to find a bottle of water on the side of the road, which through night vision goggles and through thermal sights, the shape of the water bottle looks exactly like an artillery round. So at the time, the decision to engage the vehicle was a sound one. The first team that had fired on the vehicle was they intended to disable the vehicle. By the time the vehicle came to my location, we believed that we were engaging the vehicle to destroy it. So there was a small communication breakdown there. And in the end, the guy was wounded. He lived, thank God. But what made that particular engagement interesting was the fact that emotionally, I wanted nothing more than for that grenade to hit that bus and to see the thing explode and burn. Even after the fact, knowing that it was an innocent civilian who was in that vehicle, there's still a part of me that wishes the grenade would have hit the vehicle.
Does it disturb you that you feel that way?
You know, I intellectually, yes, it does disturb me. But honestly, emotionally, it doesn't disturb me. I don't really know why, but this is the thing that I'm trying to reconcile as well. There's, why would a part, even knowing the guy was innocent, why would I still on a visceral level want the thing to have exploded? You know, I don't have the answer to that question. I don't know.
You write a little bit about times when you had to oversee Iraqi prisoners in a jail on your base. And you say that you found yourself walking a fine line between proper Geneva Convention-esque humane treatment of enemy combatants and being made a fool of by the same guys who had been making fools of your unit for the past few weeks by hitting the base with almost nightly mortars. Can you talk a little bit about walking that line, about, you know, wanting to observe the Geneva Conventions, on the other hand, not wanting to be made a fool of or being taken advantage of by the people who were your prisoners?
Well, this was a duty that I think that we were very, as infantrymen, unprepared to do. Dealing with detainees is something that's military police. That's more their job. There are people who are trained to do this. They know, they kind of know what they're getting into. As a grunt, it's, you know, that was, we were kind of thrust into this situation where sometimes we'd have to pull duty on guarding the detainees. And I think that between not being prepared to deal with detainees, and also just by virtue of the fact that I was raised in a pretty authoritarian environment. I was raised in Utah as a Mormon. It's very patriarchal, you know, my upbringing. And discipline is something that I suppose is programmed in me on some really basic level, simply because of the way that I was raised. And having detainees in my mind, I'm thinking like, well, there should be a certain level of discipline. These guys shouldn't be goofing off. They shouldn't be making fun of me. I mean, I'm the guy with the gun, right? So when sometimes we would meet this kind of resistance with the guys that we had in our cells, I felt like, well, you know, what do? Do I sacrifice? Should I allow myself to be humiliated by the guy who I'm supposed to be in charge of, or should I try to assert some kind of authority? And when I do assert my authority, how do I do that effectively? And I think in situations like that, at least for me personally, it's so easy to take things a little bit too far in an attempt to do things more correctly. And sometimes the feelings that I felt, you know, the things that I felt myself thinking in situations like this where I'm trying to deal with a really difficult detainee was very disturbing. And when you have that much power over someone, it's sometimes hard to deal with frustrating situations and still be humane.
One situation where you thought maybe you had taken it too far is when you were taping up a detainee's face with duct tape. Would you describe why you were doing that?
At the time, the policy that we had enough guys in the jail at the time that it was, whoever makes these decisions felt that it was important that these men remain blindfolded. So, okay, it's my job to make sure these guys stay in their cells, that they their blindfolds remain on, and that there's not a whole lot of chit-chat. You know, the idea being to silence them. You don't want them sharing information or getting, like, their stories straight or whatever. But I had one guy who was particularly defiant, and he kept on, his blindfold kept on falling down, or he kept on figuring out a way to, like, get his blindfold down even though his hands were bound. So I took him out of his cell. I tied a really tight blindfold on, then he managed to pull that down with his teeth. So I felt like such a jerk. The soldiers that I'm working with, I'm being made a fool of by this guy. All the other detainees are looking at me like, you know, ha-ha, we got a guy here who's, like, making you look like a jerk. So I figured, you know, I'm not going to be made a fool in this situation, so I grabbed a bunch of duct tape, and I gave him a duct tape blindfold, you know, which basically was like, okay, let me see you pull that down now, guy, which, of course, you know, he couldn't. But it's just, in that situation, I didn't feel great about myself afterward. It's like, why am I dealing with this guy like this? Why am I, you know, compromising my own sense of humanity just to assert some kind of like baloney authority I'm supposed to have right now?
Were there other times when you felt you had to compromise your sense of what was right in order to assert your authority or, you know, maintain or regain control of a situation?
Well, there were a few times, and what's the irony of it, too, is the things that you usually find yourself doing to try to, you know, grapple, to try to gain control of a situation, ultimately, you're not gaining control of the situation. For an example, we were in this town of Dujail quite a bit, you know, performing various security missions, and which basically entailed us standing around a lot, just kind of like, you know, trying to not be attacked while somebody else did something. We were guarding them. There was one day when a couple of kids were in a truck, and there's no really age, driver's license age in Iraq. These kids, they couldn't have been more than 10 or 11, were driving a truck, and they thought it was funny to, like, drive right at us and then swerve at the last minute. Now, had that been an adult doing that, I probably would have shot them and felt fine about it. But in this case, I got two 10 or 11-year-olds. I can tell they're goofing off. They want to see, you know, if they can press the soldiers' buttons. And it worked. And it's like, well, what am I going to do? I'm not going to shoot these kids. I mean, technically, they're putting my life. They're definitely a threat. What if, you know, the kid doesn't swerve correctly at the last minute? Or what if he does want to kill me? I don't know. But the kids did this twice. The second time I actually, you know, I pointed my weapon at the kid. I'm like, you know, what am I going to do? Shoot the kid? Honestly, I'm probably not going to do it. So I'm trying to assert some kind of authority again in a situation that I can't get a handle on. And in the end, what do I feel like? Well, I feel like a jerk that I let some kids, you know, play me like that, basically. And then another part of me feels bad that, like, I pointed my rifle at a kid.
You write about how you were often surrounded by children, that, you know, a lot of the troops were often surrounded by children. Were there a lot of children who were walking that line between being mischievous and genuinely threatening?
Well, I think it's probably safe to assume that none of the kids were actually a threat, but they definitely knew how to walk that line. These are kids who they grew up on the street. They were tougher than me. I hate to admit that, but they completely were. I mean, I grew up in the suburbs of Utah. I'm not a tough kid. I might know how to fight if you give me a rifle, but you know, I got in a staring contest with a kid one time and I lost. Why? These kids, they're tougher than me, and it's like, I'm like, damn it, this kid's 9. Why is he tougher than me? But sometimes they were, and they knew. And what do you do? Sometimes we could even get, like, a little bit physical with the kids, like, grab their arm, or, like, I even, like, threw small rocks at some kids one day. It's like, these things don't faze them. They're slapped around by their parents. I mean, the culture in Iraq is, they're pretty physical with punishment. There's nothing that I can do to these kids that they don't already know how to endure to no end. And it became, to try to remain tactical in an environment where you're dealing with 24 kids, you know, wanting, like, your sunglasses and candy and water and food, and, you know, they want your latest issue of Maxim magazine or something, it became so difficult to remain professional in an environment where you were basically a babysitter for juvenile delinquents.
So what did you do? I mean, did you try to stay away from the kids? Was that possible?
There really was no solution. You basically try to pawn the kids off on somebody else. Maybe you have somebody new to the group who hasn't been in town many times, and this was their first time in town. Like, go bug that guy. He has tons of water. He got lots of candy. there really wasn't a solution. You just try the best. Like, well, I guess I'm going to have to become less tactical because these kids right now are winning. The Iraqi police, they were actually pretty good. These guys are cruel enough that if we really had troubles with kids, we just grab some of the IP guys, and they had no compunction about swatting the kids, and the kids were actually pretty afraid of them. But in most cases, we just put up with it. That's all we can do.
My guest is Jason Christopher Hartley. His new book is called Just Another Soldier. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jason Christopher Hartley. His new book, Just Another Soldier, is based on the blog and the emails that he wrote while serving in Iraq in 2004 in the Army National Guard. Now, you were raised in Salt Lake City. You were brought up Mormon. You spent time in a platoon in Utah where you say 99% of the platoon was white suburbanites. Then you moved to New York City and ended up in a unit that was largely Hispanic. You say you were one of two white members of your unit. How do you think ethnic differences affected, you know, friendship and cohesiveness within the units that you served in?
I'll tell you what, the Army is an incredibly integrated organization. I think that's probably one thing they can definitely be very proud of. But despite that integration, the cliques that guys hang out in are still always down racial lines, and just simply because it's the most, you hang out with people that you have the most common, you know, background with. And I've just sort of found, and I'm not trying to make any kind of, you know, judgment on things, but I have definitely found that it's the Hispanic soldiers who are the most enjoyable to be around, and the white soldiers tend to be really insecure and uptight and are less fun to be around. When I moved to this unit in Manhattan, it was all Puerto Ricans and Dominicans, and I didn't know the military could be so much fun. And so I happily reenlisted because these are the guys that I wanted to be with. And it was interesting is when we deployed to Iraq is we had to sort of smush two companies together, one that was primarily white and one that was my unit that was primarily Hispanic. And that was kind of a continual source of conflict within platoons, within the company, was problems that involved, you know, they didn't involve race directly, but they could be drawn down racial lines.
You're right. The chances of my personally capturing Osama bin Laden are slim, but I'd like to do something a little more than just simply being in the Army and sometimes sending money to the ACLU. Do you feel like the work you did in Iraq helped stop terrorism? Do you feel like the war in Iraq is helping to stop terrorism?
I want to give you a direct answer, so I'm going to say this. No, it's not helping it. It's a phenomenal training ground right now. If you're a terrorist or you're an aspiring terrorist and you want to learn how to fight a guerrilla war, go to Iraq. I mean, because it's an awesome place to do it right now. And I know there's people who are probably going to hate me for saying that, but as far as, you know, actual quantifiable results on this war on terror, what we're doing in Iraq, at this moment in time, today, it's not helping. Maybe 10 years from now, if we can, like, you know, start thinking constructively and creatively, it can be. If we can stabilize Iraq, set up shop over there, and maybe the Middle East will be less of a problem for us as far as a breeding ground for terrorists, and then, yeah, then the end will have justified the means, and the answer to that question will be yes, it was effective. But today, no, it's not.
So what did you do with that thought during the year when you were in Iraq risking your life? So you were doing this for a war against terrorism, but you felt that this was more contributing to terrorism, to training more terrorists, than it was preventing the spread of terrorism.
Well, I most definitely, absolutely did not have that thought while I was in Iraq.
You didn't?
I've been back for 9 months, and I've had a lot of time to kind of mull things over, and that's a conclusion that I've come to personally since I've been back, not while I was there. I've been staunchly apolitical my entire life, and it's because I hate the conundrum of these types of, these arguments that seem to not really go anywhere. And I think, in my opinion, to be an effective, the most effective soldiers are ones who are able to divorce themselves from these ideas. I mean, the guys that we were fighting, they were fighting for a cause. I didn't want to fight for a cause. If anything, I fought for fighting's sake. I just like to fight. I'm a soldier, and my country, I believe, is a decent country, and I'm hoping that if it's going to go into combat, they're going to choose a good reason to do it. So I felt as though I'm relieved of a certain amount of, moral decision-making. And then from there, I just wanted to do my job, do it well, and try and do it humanely. So, you know, these were not thoughts that I had while I was there, and I didn't want to have to worry about it. I was afraid that I might come to the realization that I have now, which is that it was a mistake to invade Iraq and that I could potentially be doing something completely wrong. If I was worrying about that kind of thing there, that could have seriously degraded my effectiveness as a soldier and therefore, you know, degrade my ability to defend myself and my friends.
When you did get home, some people would come up to you and say, I don't support the war, but I support you. What was your reaction to hearing that?
I felt good about that. I felt it made me proud for them. It made me proud that today in America, you know, it's not like Vietnam. And soldiers talk about this a lot, too. We always say to each other, you know, thank God this isn't Vietnam. We come home, people might say, I think this war is garbage, but you're not. You don't represent the decisions of the administration. I respect you. I respect your service, but I disagree with this war. And I thought, you know, that's a person who has intellectual integrity and a lot of respect for a person who might be doing a job that they wouldn't want to do. And every time, I've never got tired of hearing that. It made me feel good.
You got into trouble for keeping a military blog. Are there military blogs now, or has everybody been forced to take them down?
No, there's probably more now than there ever have been, which is really kind of interesting. When I started my blog, there was only one other blog I was able to find that was by an infantryman, and it was really the guy was, you know, I'll give him credit. The guy was a grunt. His English skills weren't phenomenal. So I thought, oh, this is cool. Maybe I can actually, like, you know, blaze a new trail and write a blog from an infantryman's point of view that hasn't been done before. But now it's like there's, you know, every other guy carrying an M4 right now has a blog.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Jason Christopher Hartley's new book is called Just Another Soldier. He's still a member of the Army National Guard in New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, featuring Bob and Melinda Blanchard's Live What You Love, Notes from an Unusual Life, available in stores and at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/fresh air. And from 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting the epic adventure Kingdom of Heaven from the director of Gladiator and starring Orlando Bloom on DVD. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, screenwriter and director Noah Baumbach talks about his new film, The Squid and the Whale. It's loosely based on his memories of how his parents' divorce changed his life. The film stars Jeff Daniels as a pretentious and self-absorbed writer and professor, and Laura Linney as his wife, who's establishing her own writing career. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the 90s, my guest Noah Baumbach wrote and directed the films Kicking and Screaming and Mr. Jealousy. He co-wrote the screenplay for last year's film, The Life Aquatic, with Steve Zissou. Baumbach's new film, The Squid and the Whale, is loosely based on his experiences when his parents divorced. His father is the writer Jonathan Baumbach, his mother, the film critic Georgia Brown. The Squid and the Whale stars Jeff Daniels as Bernard, a pretentious, self-absorbed English professor and novelist who's starting to feel a bit overshadowed by his wife's new writing career. It's the wife, Joan, played by Laura Linney, who's decided the marriage is over. Bernard is miserable about this, and so are the two children, 16-year-old Walt and 12-year-old Frank. The film is set in the 1980s in the Park Slope neighborhood of Brooklyn, where Baumbach grew up. In this scene, the parents have sat the kids down for a family meeting.
Okay. Your mom and I... Okay, yeah. Mom and I are going... We're going to separate.
You're not going to be leaving either of us.
We're going to have joint custody. Frank, it's okay. I've got an elegant new house across the park.
Across the park? Is that even Brooklyn?
It's only 5 stops on the subway. It's an elegant block, the filet of the neighborhood. We'll have a ping pong table.
I don't play ping pong.
And we'll both see you equally.
How will that work?
We're splitting up the week, alternating days.
Why?
Because I love you and I want to see you as much as your mother does.
But there's 7 days.
Right.
So how will you split evenly with 7 days?
Oh, I've got you Tuesday, Wednesday, and Saturday, and every other Thursday.
Every other?
That's how we each have you equally.
That was your father's idea.
Don't do this.
How will I get to school?
There's a subway 4 blocks from the house. 4 or 5. No more than 6 blocks.
And what about the cat?
The cat.
We didn't discuss the cat.
Your father will pick him up on those days when you're switching houses.
I'll have to drive here 2 additional times a week.
You got a place on the other side of the park. If you'd gotten a place near here, it wouldn't be a problem.
This neighborhood's gotten very expensive. Joan, it's very painful for me to stay in this neighborhood. You know that. Don't be difficult. I feel banished.
Oh, pickle.
So, Dad, what will happen with the cat?
We'll figure something out.
Noah Baumbach, welcome back to Fresh Air. In your movie, the parents divorce, and they want to do joint custody. And joint custody always seems like such a kind of civil, reasonable thing to do instead of fighting over custody. Mm-hmm. But, of course, the kids really don't like this idea at all because they're going to be having to go, you know, Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays to one house and Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to another. And I guess it was easy for you to see it from the kids' point of view because that's the point of view you saw the divorce from when your parents separated. Did they do joint custody with you?
They did, and that's actually my actual joint custody arrangement in the movie was the one we had. They were, as you said, they were very reasonable, rational people. They had it all figured out. And I think probably until I actually wrote it down, I didn't realize how bizarre it was.
So how did it work for you going back and forth?
I was a teenager, and I, you know, sort of also at a point in my life where in some ways having a separate life from your parents is starting to become important to you. It's part of your own sort of sense of self and identification. So to be sort of, you know, trapped in this arrangement where I didn't have the power to break a night, you know, if it was more convenient for me to, I was nearer to my mother's and wanted to go there, I still had to go to my dad's. And it became, it was so incredibly rigid. So I hated it. You know, I think I was often told at the time, you know, that I had, it was actually more, you know, deeper, more painful feelings that I was probably sort of sublimating with more this sense of annoyance, you know, in the joint custody arrangement. But in, you know, I think part of the thing I realized when I wrote the script is that actually these little irritations weren't so little. This was a big deal. It was a huge imposition, you know, on the kids. And, it's something in a way I even became more attuned to as I wrote the script and then made the movie.
You grew up in a house where, you know, your parents were writers. They were intellectuals. The film is filled with the kind of problems a child would face growing up in a home like that. For example, the difficulty of developing your own opinions when your parents' opinions mm-hmm. are so strong, particularly about the arts. For example, in the movie, the father will say when talking about F. Scott Fitzgerald, "Oh, Tender is the Night, that's minor Fitzgerald." Mm-hmm. And so if anybody asks the teenage son if he's read Tender is the Night, he'll just shrug his shoulders dismissively and say, "Oh, that's minor Fitzgerald." But of course, he's never read Fitzgerald, and he has no real opinion of his own of Fitzgerald. But he knows what he's supposed to think based on what his father thinks. And it's obviously going to be very hard for him to develop a sense of intellectual independence. That's the kind of issue I think that's not really brought up a whole lot in movies. You know, developing intellectual independence when you're around mm-hmm. strong intellectual parents. Can you talk a little bit about trying to address that in the movie?
Well, I think it is interesting, and I've found it in my life, you know, my own life, but also people I know who come from similar backgrounds. The sort of idea of opinion as definition, in a way, you know, that you kind of define yourself by what you like, you know, and so if lots of people like one thing, you know, it becomes harder to define yourself that way, because it's like, well, if everybody likes Titanic, you know, I can't be the guy who likes Titanic. You know, so you need to then pick the thing that fewer people like, you know, the thing that fewer people have seen, in a way. And so it becomes a way for you to be defined by this work of art, you know, whether it's a book or a movie or, you know, music. And I think you're right. I think on one hand, I think growing up among intellectuals and people who are, you know, interested and sophisticated about art can be terrific. I think it's great for kids to be introduced to all these things. But I think there is that danger where you suddenly are skipping so far ahead. You know, I mean, as a kid, I used to like dismiss, you know, Kurt Vonnegut and Tom Robbins and Jack Kerouac, you know, as sort of adolescent, you know. You know, meanwhile, I was an adolescent,
right?
And so I was sort of jumping ahead to books that were more sophisticated, and in a lot of cases too sophisticated for me to even read. So it kind of left me in some ways paralyzed, and that's something I really, you know, went into with Walt in this movie, is that exact problem.
Jeff Daniels as the father, I think, does a really terrific job. Did you give him any advice about how to play this character?
Yeah. Jeff and I had a great experience with Jeff. Jeff has these kind of great sad blue eyes, and I sort of imagined, you know, if we gave him a beard sort of surrounding those eyes, it could be kind of incredible. So I told him to grow a beard, and you know, and I've been telling people I feel like the beard he grew in a way symbolizes his commitment to this character, because when he showed up, his beard was so huge and his hair was so long. It was almost, you know, out of Grizzly Man or something. And he we had to trim it back even. But, you know, I have a lot of sympathy for that character. And it's interesting because it's a character that really polarizes people. I mean, a lot of people see the movie and they're like, oh, the father's a bad guy. What a bad father. And then other people really, you know, care for him and recognize his struggles and how hard it is for him. I mean, I had a Q&A in Toronto where I ended up sort of putting together this some strange sentence telling someone that unsympathetic people need our sympathy more than sympathetic people. And I was like, not exactly sure what I was saying, but I knew it meant something. But I talked to Jeff a lot about all the various sort of walls and boundaries that Bernard puts up around himself. I mean, all the sort of the talking that in a way is smokescreen. It's, you know, it's the, you know, whatever, like animal spray to kind of keep you away from them. I think Bernard is so vulnerable on some level, but he's created such a thick barrier around himself that I think he's afraid that any chink in it is going to just take him down entirely. And I think this is largely unconscious, by the way. I don't think Bernard is aware of this. But I think Bernard's ideas of success and, you know, failure are so out of whack with any kind of real success. I mean, I've seen people write about Bernard and refer to him as a failed novelist. And, you know, it's true that in the movie he doesn't have an agent and he's, you know, clearly things have been better for him. But he's still doing okay. It's not like he's, you know, in a way I feel like when they write that, they're taking Bernard on his own terms. And so I talked to Jeff a lot about that. I also think that Bernard makes, and this is, again, unconscious, but he makes people feel sorry for him. You know, I think part of the reason it's really hard to confront him, particularly for his kids, is I think that there's always something there that makes you want to protect him. And I think Joan, in a way, had to become ruthless to get away from him, you know, I mean, to break up with him. And that's what Walt is reacting to. He's very angry at his mother from his perspective, you know, being so mean to his father and, you know, rejecting him. But I think in some ways Bernard makes it impossible to sort of rationally separate from him or to even just take a break. I think he so makes you feel like you need to be there for him. And it's a very strange thing because it's, on one hand, I think he makes you feel like you need to take care of him. And on the other hand, he wants you to idolize him.
My guest is screenwriter and director Noah Baumbach. His new film is called The Squid and the Whale. He also wrote and directed the films Kicking and Screaming and Mr. Jealousy, and co-wrote The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Noah Baumbach. He wrote and directed the new film The Squid and the Whale, about an intellectual couple in Brooklyn and how their separation changes the lives of their two children. It stars Jeff Daniels and Laura Linney. Well, you know, we've been talking about the father in the story, but the mother, as you've written her, is very interesting. You know, she is not as self-involved as the father is and doesn't seem to have as big and complex an ego. At the same time, she's apparently very talented. She has a book that's published during the course of the movie, and her career might actually be overtaking her husband's. Mm-hmm. And she also, you know, she's having affairs, and the boys find out about this. And so there's times when you are really with her emotionally watching this movie, and other times when you feel like, oh, she shouldn't be doing this. You know, and it's, you know, it's not good for her sons. Did you find yourself on her side or ambivalent about her?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think, you know, on one hand, I did not want to judge either parent at any point, but I do think her character reveals itself, you know, in a different way than Bernard's does. I mean, Bernard in some ways is revealing himself or trying to reveal himself or actually trying not to reveal himself at every moment. But he's very present. And we, in some ways, learn a lot about what Joan has done or, you know, has said off camera as the movie goes. And I think partly because, you know, she's, you know, her intentions, you know, or her motivation in some ways is, you know, a mystery to these kids. I think, you know, what I like about the movie is that I think at any point that you can start to feel like, oh, this guy, I'm behind this person. I'm behind, oh, I get, you know, you identify with people. I mean, that's what it's about to some degree. Oh, I identify with them. And then suddenly they do something where you're like, oh God, you know, I don't, you know, that behavior was unexpected in some way, but you know, hopefully it's part of, you know, the whole package. And also in some ways, it's also more identifiable because we all act, you know, in complicated, bad and good ways all the time.
The older son, the teenager, in The Squid and the Whale, takes a song by Pink Floyd and passes it off as his own, takes credit for writing it. It's easy for a while for him to get away with that. What made you think about that?
I had actually had a friend in college who told me a story about how he had tried to pass off the Who song Behind Blue Eyes as his own to his parents and how they bought it and how he lived with this kind of guilt. And then, you know, and then he had the kind of funny story of how it came on the radio when they were all in the car together and his father turned around and said, I thought you wrote this. And I always found it such an amusing story, I think partly because it felt like some alternate version of me. You know, it was like I didn't do, you know, I wasn't as sort of maybe bold as that to, you know, do that. I also wasn't good enough at guitar. But I, you know, somehow when I was writing it, it seemed like, you know, I mean, and it's that thing when you're, you know, you take things from your own life and then you take things from outside and somehow, you know, it's, you know, in some ways it felt like, well, that's almost more my story than my, some of the real stories I have. So I brought that in and I picked Pink Floyd because I felt closer to Pink Floyd, and than I did to that Who song. And also it was a song that is so intense and dramatic, and I just thought it was really funny that a 16-year-old would have written it or claimed to have written it.
Writers and critics, like your parents or the parents in the movie tend to really value honesty when it comes to their writing. And sometimes that requires almost a brutal honesty in which you might feel like you are betraying somebody that you love, but to capture the reality of the scene or your genuine reaction to the movie or to the book, you have to be honest, and that's part of your job. But writers who subscribe to that ethic of honesty don't necessarily enjoy being written about honestly themselves.
No, it's true.
How did your writer parents react to the portrayal of parents in your movie? Now, I mean, you are not writing about your parents. The movie is fiction, but we will all assume that to some extent it's based on the reality of your life. So what was it like for them to watch these portrayals? These not always flattering portrayals.
Well, I do think it's affectionate at the same time that, you know, certainly it's critical. And both my parents are fiction writers, so, and they've both written about their parents in fictional ways. So, you know, I think, you know, as best as you can in a situation like this, I really think they see it as a movie. They actually both just saw it for the second time on Monday. And I could tell, like, you know, by their faces afterward, I mean, they really, you know, enjoyed, you know, being there. And I think they're also proud of me, you know, and excited for me, you know. And I think now they could see it, you know, the first time they saw it, I'm sure there was, like, this sort of, you know, like you're watching a movie with your foot on the brakes, like, of, like, you know, what's going to happen here. But I think seeing it a second time, at least they, you know, they knew what to expect to some degree, and were able to kind of, you know, let go a little more, you know. But that said, I'm sure it's weird. but it's a funny thing, because it's I do believe that if I hadn't fictionalized the movie as effectively as I have, it wouldn't feel as real as it does. And a lot of people have a very kind of raw experience watching the movie, which I love. I want that to be, I want that to be what the experience is. But, you know, for me, and I think subsequently for them now at this point, the movie is almost protective. It's not raw. It's another thing. It's a movie.
Did you talk with your parents about the portrayal of the parents before writing the movie?
No, I kept them out of the writing process, and which, you know, in some ways, you know, which makes the reality of this movie great for a therapy session, is that I had also, before this, you know, writing this film, I'd always shown my parents everything I wrote, you know, I mean, just to even get notes from them. And in a way, you know, probably there was a side of me that wanted to write something that in some ways, by definition, I couldn't show them. And so... it was important to me, and some, you know, I think, to just make this my own experience writing this thing, and not worry about feelings, and trust in some way that, you know, I was, you know, in control of it, both from a fictional standpoint, but also just from an honesty standpoint, that was going to, you know, it would kind of take care of itself. That if it was, I did bring my parents into the process later when I was in pre-production. Because it was different. It was okay. Well, now we're actually shooting. Some of it was practical. I wanted to get, you know, props from their homes, and you know, I dressed Jeff Daniels in my dad's clothes, and I wanted to sort of, you know, then use them as resource. And again, not as like resource in a kind of like, oh, because they're playing them, but as resources because they were there too, and they, they could contribute.
My guest is screenwriter and director Noah Baumbach. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
We'll be right back.
My guest is Noah Baumbach. He wrote and directed the new film, The Squid and the Whale. You have written and directed your movies, but there's one movie that you wrote that you didn't direct that was directed by Wes Anderson, and that's The Life Aquatic mm-hmm. with Steve Zissou, which starred Bill Murray and Owen Wilson. And Wes Anderson produced this new movie that you wrote and directed. How did you end up in a partnership with him?
Well, our sort of professional relationship came out of our friendship, which had started in sort of the late 90s. I think we'd both initially had started hearing about each other because our first two movies, or his first movie and my first movie, Bottle Rocket being his and Kicking and Screaming being mine, came out around the same time. It was around 1995, and both underperformed brilliantly at the box office, and but they often both had very committed fans. Those who had seen it were very committed about them, and so we both heard a lot about each other. So when we met, we sort of, in some ways, felt, I think, some kind of kinship, and we became really great friends. And it's a funny thing sometimes to be asked about our professional relationship, like how does Wes influence you, and what have you gotten from Wes, and that's what's so enjoyable to me about it. I mean, both his work as a producer on this movie and my work as a co-writer on The Life Aquatic, it feels so much like an extension of our friendship, and so it's a nice thing.
It seems in some ways that your sensibilities are really different, and yet you've collaborated on movies.
Yeah, I mean, again, that's sort of, in some ways it's harder for me to see it that way because as friends we have so much in common, and we love talking about movies and books and, you know, people and psychology, whatever you talk about as friends. And, you know, but yeah, I do think, you know, I think we're distinct, both of us, as filmmakers, and I think that's, you know, that's what I love about him as a filmmaker. And what I loved about working on Life Aquatic, because I think it was like, here was my chance to participate in a movie that I would never have made, you know, on my own. I wouldn't have even, you know, approached that subject matter, you know, I mean, so it was a kind of, you know, a pleasure. It was sort of like being able to, you know, enter someone else's movie, you know, and something that, you know, I guess, you know, I do as a viewer all the time, but here I was able to do it and actually participate and contribute. And I think a similar thing for him too. I mean, I think with this is not, you know, a style of movie that he would necessarily approach on his own. And it was his, but, you know, but it's something he really appreciates and values. So he was able to, you know, be a part of it and contribute to it likewise in a way that, you know, gave him pleasure.
The actor who plays the 12-year-old son in your movie has to say a lot of dirty language, bad words. And did his parents object at all to having to say that stuff in the movie?
Well, it's funny because his parents are actually friends of ours. His parents are the actors, Kevin Kline and Phoebe Cates. And my wife is Jennifer Jason Leigh, and she and Phoebe have known each other since Fast Times. So we often would have Sunday dinner. I mean, they're like family in a way. And I had, at the time, had been auditioning all these kids, and as you point out, it's a difficult role, and it's also a difficult role to audition people for, because you don't want to turn them off of their parents off of it too fast, and I was having a lot of trouble. I mean, it was a very, you know, I mean, it's one of those parts that if you don't get it exactly right, it's, you know, it's trouble. And Jennifer kept saying to me, you know, you need someone like Owen. You know, Owen has this kind of just this genuine openness, but he's so bright, and he's, you know, there's something just so very natural and soulful about him. It was one of those things that one evening at dinner, I just got the guts to ask. And they had already read the script because they were friends and I'd shown it to them. And so they knew what they were getting into. And, you know, I think it's sort of not unlike, you know, you're asking me about what my parents think, and I say they're writers. I mean, I think in this case, they're actors. You know, they know, you know, they know all the fakery of it. And again, Owen is such a sane kind of amazing kid, and his relationship with his parents is so, you know, close and wonderful that, you know, saying those bad words and things, it wasn't like, you know, he was prepared for it. He knew them. He knew he was acting. It wasn't like, you know, there was any danger of him, you know, running around town saying those things.
Well, I could see this really awkward situation develop where he'd say that at the dinner table or something, and his parents would have to say, you can't talk that way at the dinner table. You can only talk that way in the movies.
Right, right. It's a very rarefied conversation.
Noah Baumbach, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was fun.
Noah Baumbach wrote and directed the new film, The Squid and the Whale. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Hey, you, out there in the cold, getting lonely, getting old, can you feel me? Hey, you, standing in the aisles with itchy feet and fainting smiles, can you feel me? Hey, you, don't help them to bury the light. Don't give in without a fight.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD or video available at 877-ENDLESS or endlesspool.com. From the Alzheimer's Association, advancing research, providing care and support services, and promoting healthy brains at alz.org. And from 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting the epic adventure Kingdom of Heaven, from the director of Gladiator and starring Orlando Bloom, on DVD. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, musicians Harry Connick Jr. and Branford Marsalis share memories of New Orleans and of each other in their formative years. They have a new CD of duets. Join us for the next Fresh Air.